Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt, and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And so this week is a kind of second part, or continuing on of our conversation we started last week, where we were discussing baby loss awareness week here in the UK, miscarriage, and I guess before we kick off again, another health warning, a trigger warning. We are going to continue talking about some of these themes, and in particular also drawing the conversation on to abortion, where that's going to be a very painful topic for many of those listening. You know, statistics show that I think approximately 1 in 3 women have an abortion at some point in their lives, and 1 in 5, 1 in 6 pregnancies end in miscarriage. So these painful topics affect almost everyone in some ways. Please be aware of that before we continue. But we wanted to really kind of draw out that final point from the conversation on miscarriage and about the really healthy and helpful change in language and approach, the much more compassionate and kind of emotionally sensitive approach that recognizes children who die before they're born are still children, are still babies, and talk about what that means or how that affects the conversation we also have in society around abortion.
Yeah, it is an extraordinary phenomenon that miscarriage and abortion are both extremely common. And yet, the narratives that surround them are very different. And so, if we just review what's been happening with abortion in the UK, and I think perhaps the first thing just to say, I know we have many listeners around the world, including in the US, where the whole context in which abortion occurs is very, very different. And so it might be worth just very briefly recapping how abortion developed in the UK. I think the important point is that, first of all, we had one of the very first abortion laws in the world, and it was framed, a legal abortion was framed entirely in terms of medical risk. It's interesting that in the law it really says nothing about a mother's choice. It's entirely framed in terms of the risk to the mother's health and life, or the health and welfare of existing children. And it's two doctors who have to determine whether the risks of continuing the pregnancy are greater than having an abortion. And but also importantly, once that act came in 1967, the NHS rapidly regarded providing legal abortions according to the Abortion Act was an NHS responsibility, and it became part of universal healthcare. And so every NHS region, every district, every hospital had to ensure that it was providing an abortion service under the terms of the Act. And of course, this is very different from what happened in the US, where the majority of mainstream health providers and hospitals decided that they didn't want to be involved in abortion, and therefore it was something almost entirely carried out by charities such as Planned Parenthood. So ever since then, we have had freely available abortion under the NHS, provided it met the criteria of the Act. And over the years, there's been a sort of progressive increase in numbers, steadily increasing overall year by year. And that increase has remained a huge matter of concern, not just for those who are really concerned about the morality of abortion, but also just from a public health point of view. Because it was always said, once you make universal sex education and free contraception available, it was always predicted that the need for abortion will wither away. Why on earth would you need that? If everybody understood, had proper sex education and access to free contraception, unplanned pregnancy will become increasingly rare. And yet, we seem to be seeing exactly the reverse, that rates continue to rise.
And that's the case even though, encouragingly, the UK has seen a lot of progress in reducing the incidence of teenage pregnancy and things like that, which was a huge kind of cause for concern in the kind of 80s and 90s. And actually, numbers have been steadily dropping since then. And so I suppose a lot of the people who are having abortions are not going to be your kind of stereotypical 17-year-old girl who accidentally fell pregnant with her boyfriend and is, you know, too young or terrified about the prospect of becoming a mother. You know, a lot of people having abortions are going to be women in their 20s and 30s who are in stable long-term relationships, but for various reasons decide, I do not want to see this pregnancy through.
That's absolutely right. And there has been a dramatic fall in teenage pregnancies, and probably a major factor has been the use of long-term implantable contraception, which means that a person doesn't have to remember to take a contraceptive pill or use a condom or something like that.
Hmm.
But the peak age group for abortions is in the early to mid-20s. But as you say, many of the people who are having abortions are in stable relationships, by no means not all. And one way of looking at this is that the mean age of onset of regular intercourse is about 16 in our country at the moment. The mean age at which women want to have their first baby is around 30. And so if you just put it like that, what it says is that many people in our society want to have regular intercourse, but they don't want to have a baby for whatever reason. And that means it's almost inevitable there are going to be unplanned pregnancies, there are going to be contraceptive failures, there are going to be, you know, social events and coerced unplanned sex and all the rest. So, but nonetheless, the continuing rise in abortion rates are a matter of concern. And what the evidence is now coming out that here in the UK, we've seen quite a significant rise just in the last 2 or 3 years.
Yes. And is that being driven by something to do with the pandemic? Do we understand what is behind that?
I don't think we do. And actually, there's a bit of a problem because we don't have the latest figures. The latest figures we have in the UK were the first 6 months of 2022. But this showed a 17% increase on 2021. Which is itself quite striking. And there is anecdotal evidence that in 2023, one of the major abortion providers reported an increase of about 30% on year in the number of abortions they were providing. So there certainly seems to be a very significant increase. Now, and what the reasons are, I think, is still largely a matter of speculation.
Okay, so we've got increasing numbers of abortion, and despite a quite medicalized framework passed in the original 1967 Act, in reality, it has been interpreted or used by the NHS to effectively offer abortion on demand. You do have to give a formal reason, but one of the reasons is, you know, I'm paraphrasing, it would cause, you know, harm to the mother's mental health. And so women overwhelmingly select that option as their kind of justification for why they would like an abortion. And on the whole, that's not questioned or probed. That's just accepted as a matter of fact.
Well, just to correct you, the women don't select the option. It's the doctor who is responsible to decide under which ground the abortion. So it's the doctor who says this abortion would be appropriate under, and it's a particular ground which says continuing the pregnancy has a greater risk to the mental health or physical health of the mother than performing abortion. And the statistics show that an early abortion performed under good medical conditions has a lower risk to the mother compared with a pregnancy continuing to term and delivering a baby at term. And therefore, effectively, a doctor could argue that in any case, virtually any case, the risks of doing an abortion are less than the risks of continuing the pregnancy.
And in reality, it's unheard of for women who wish to have an abortion to be refused, whatever their circumstances, as long as they meet the legal criteria in terms of gestation of the child, they are granted the right to an abortion.
Yes, the other criteria that the doctor has to, or whoever is assessing the person, is to assess that they are making a genuinely free choice. And that means that they, counsellors who are assessing women, are told that they must check, quotes, that the woman is not being coerced by anybody to have an abortion. And so, for instance, if she's seen at an abortion clinic, it is offered to her. If she comes with a partner, and if the counsellor suspects there is some coercion going on, the counsellor can ensure that the woman is seen in private alone, and that is offered, you know, can express whether or not she genuinely wants to go ahead with the abortion. So another important development in the narrative about abortion was the development of pills by post. It has been true that for many years, abortion activists have wanted to demedicalize the whole process of the abortion. They wanted to take it away from a medical control and make it something that could happen in a patient's home without direct medical involvement. And so this was always resisted by governments and by many doctors. And that was why the Abortion Act said that abortion could only take place in a licensed premises, and that was either an NHS hospital or a properly licensed abortion clinic. But what happened in the pandemic is that emergency regulations were brought in because of the risk of cross-infection, and it was agreed by Parliament that the requirement for a woman to attend an abortion clinic to receive the pills and be assessed would be taken away. And so we moved to what was called pills by post. And so the current situation, because it is now continuing in the same vein, the current situation is that a woman merely has to ring a number and say that she is pregnant and would like to have an abortion. She has a telephone consultation. And provided that she says that she's less than 10 weeks gestation, and the person on the end of the phone, who's the counsellor or midwife, is convinced that this is that she's acting genuinely and is not coerced, she will be sent a pack, including the abortion medication and also a pregnancy test to check after several weeks to see that the abortion has been successful. And so this is currently going on. And one of the, I think, interesting and disturbing factors is that it's not even necessary for the person's own general practitioner to be informed. This can be kept entirely confidential within the abortion clinic or wherever it's being managed, and apart from keeping statistics, nobody else need know.
And has there been a general shift before this away from kind of surgical abortions towards medical abortions anyway? And this has kind of accelerated that, because previously you'd have to come to a clinic and take a pill. But already, am I right in thinking the majority of abortions were medical, you know, as a result of taking medication rather than having a surgical operation?
That's right. And so that this has been a big shift taking place over many years. Previously, it was the majority of abortions were actually performed as surgical procedures under a general anaesthetic in a hospital or an abortion clinic. But there's been a steady increase in the numbers of medical abortions using pills. And currently, I think the statistics are about 85% of all abortions in the UK are now medical. And the recent statistics suggest that about 50% of those are happening at home without any involvement in a clinic. And
which is remarkable, given that until 2020, such a thing was literally impossible. And now almost half of all abortions now take place completely at home, outside of a medical setting, with, as you have expressed, very limited regulation or oversight or safeguards.
It is remarkable. And already we're starting to see those people who work in the area reporting, starting to see, you know, unanticipated consequences of all this. And if you think about it, you know, you imagine here is a woman, she may be married, or maybe in a stable relationship, she may be not in a stable relationship. She discovers she's pregnant, she agonizes about what to do, she phones the number, she gets the pills. Some counsellors have said that women have described, you know, I've got the pills, they're sitting on my kitchen table. I'm not sure whether I should take them or not. I keep staring at them. So you know, am I going to take them or not? And then if I do take them, I can have really quite unpleasant symptoms, cramping, pain, nausea, and then bleeding. And all this is going to take place in my bathroom. Hmm. And without, nobody need know what's going on. There might be other children in the flat. There might be other people there. Do they know what's going on? Are they aware of this, you know, this painful reality that's going on? And then we're having people saying, you know, it was a terrible thing that happened, and it all happened in my bathroom. And now every time I go to have a shower, I have flashbacks. And we've heard of people who said, I have to move from my flat. I cannot stay in that place. This is just too painful. So this kind of, it's just a very strange kind of shift in people's experience. And yet the statistics suggest, you know, that over 100,000 abortions will have taken place at home in the last year. And anecdotally, the numbers are increasing.
And it's striking to me as well that, you know, this was first introduced as a kind of temporary COVID measure when we were all locked down at homes. And it, you know, you can understand the rationale behind the argument that says, you know, previously women had to physically come into a clinic to get these pills, but they easily fit into an envelope. Why don't we temporarily make it a provision? But it is striking to me at how little debate there was about that at first. And then 2 years later, when the lockdown was long over, there was no pandemic justification for it, the government decided to extend this permanently and make it permanently available, again, with almost no, as far as I can recall, kind of public debate or conversation around it. As you're saying, quite a major reform to how abortion works in this country.
Yes, and that word reform is very loaded, isn't it? Because part of me is just thinking that, you know, the emotional reality for thousands and thousands of women, is this really a reform? You know, at least if I was having an abortion in an abortion clinic, there were professionals there. There was somebody who would hold my hand. There was somebody who would make me a cup of tea and support me emotionally and be there for me. But if this is happening alone and in my bathroom, some of it feels almost brutal, and, you know, to say that this is an advance in compassionate care, it seems quite hard.
And strikingly, the complete opposite trajectory to the conversation around, you know, miscarriage and the ending of a baby's life from another way. You know, that has all been about, let's bring it into the light. Let's talk about this more. Let's make sure women don't go through this alone. And here the trajectory on abortion is the opposite. It's the ultimate privatization of abortion, saying, no, let's push this out of the public sphere into the private sphere, potentially even something that women do completely by themselves, you know, never speaking to another human being except on the phone or on some video consultation, at home, alone, in their bathrooms, maybe their partners, maybe their other children have no idea what's going on, and saying this is something that women, a road that women must walk or should walk entirely by themselves.
Yes, and, you know, I don't read out these words in any sense to, you know, with any kind of trying to make a point or anything else, but these are the words I found on one of the leading pregnancy abortion providers, where the question was, you know, how should I deal with the pregnancy remains? And what it says on the website is, it says, you will pass the pregnancy at home or another place of your choosing. You can decide how you wish to dispose of the pregnancy remains. They can be flushed down the lavatory, wrapped in tissue, placed in a small plastic bag, and put in the dustbin. And so the contrast between, you know, these are people desperately trying to be compassionate, to be sensitive, to recognize the distress that an abortion must be causing. But the contrast between the narrative that we saw last week, where we were talking about Baby Loss Awareness Week, is very striking.
And I guess the way this connects to our previous conversation about miscarriage is the kind of slightly jarring narratives around the two things. You know, we talked last week about how, thankfully, the language and the culture around miscarriage and baby loss has changed. And now everyone, or increasingly people, would talk about these as babies who were precious, who were human like us, who mattered, and this goes back as young as 2, 3, 4 weeks since conception, that they cannot be replaced, that they count, that they will leave, you know, a lifelong impact on their parents, however short their lives were. And yet at the same time, when it comes to pregnancies which end not in miscarriage but in abortion, we deny almost every element of that. And we talk about, these are not babies, these are fetuses or just pregnancies. They're not human. They're not equivalent to us. The ending of their life won't leave any lasting impact on anyone around them. And it's this, when you hold these two narratives side by side, it's striking.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and can only come to you each week through the support of listeners like you. Your support today is so important that we want to thank you for your gift by giving you a copy of Premier Insight's brand new ebook on artificial intelligence called The Robot Race. In it, two experts in AI and robotics discuss the implications of AI technology and explore what we can learn about the human race in the light of AI's growing capabilities. You'll gain insights into how your Christian faith can inform your view of this world-changing technology and its implications on your life and the future of humanity. Again, this ebook is our thanks to you for your gift in support of this program to help equip more Christians to confidently discuss their faith as it intersects with every aspect of life. To get your copy of The Robot Race, simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
So I guess the question that then arises for us is, how is it possible that these two different narratives that seem to be almost polar opposites around babies and pregnancies and baby loss, how can they run side by side in a single society? How can a lot of the same individuals believe in both of these stories at the same time?
And my response is that this is fundamentally an unstable situation. This simply cannot persist indefinitely. And I personally think that the baby loss narrative will become more dominant. And that I think that what we need, just as we need to hear the stories, the authentic stories of people of what it felt like to lose a baby, as we already saw on the website and the Baby Loss Awareness Week. So I think we just need to hear the authentic story of what it felt like for women to have an abortion and what their emotions and feelings were. I know from past experience that often when women talk about their own abortions, they often use language about babies. So whereas the professionals are bending over backwards to use extremely sanitized language about pregnancy loss and remains, it seems that often women are more in touch with the reality of what is going on. And therefore, I think that just encouraging people to be honest, not trying to score points. Of course, you know, it is a very polarized situation and everybody's coming from somewhere. And, you know, as a pediatrician and as a Christian, I do strongly believe that every life is precious and every life is unique. And this recognition of the significance of the life of the baby in the womb is something which I think is deeply embedded in our humanity. And it's as though our society is rediscovering this.
Yeah. I mean, the tagline of Baby Loss Awareness Week is breaking the silence around baby loss. And it's hard to disagree with the idea that actually there's another silence, another taboo around abortion, something that, you know, affects a huge number of women, but for whom women often feel unwilling or unable for various reasons to talk about. And it can only be healthy for us as a society to not kind of have this conspiracy of silence and obfuscation, but instead to hear people to be honest about how it felt, about who they think was aborted or what was aborted, and to be able to share stories, because as you say, akin to what was on the Baby Loss website, Awareness Week website. I guess, but another question I would have is, for those who do kind of hold those two things in attention, you know, massive sensitivity around miscarriage and baby loss and the use of all the language of baby, whilst also a total commitment to a kind of abortion on demand as a fundamental human right for all women, which is probably a large number of people believe those two things side by side, is the way they square that circle all about saying that the status of the child is really dependent on the parent's desire? And so when a child is desired and then they die through miscarriage, that's a tragedy. They are an equal human being to us, and we must, you know, grieve with them as a bereavement. When the child is not desired and they die as a result of an abortion, that is a morally neutral act that wasn't a human being, but just a clump of cells. And so, as you say, the kind of morality state, the moral status of the fetus is almost dependent on how their parents think about it.
Yes, I think that many people, including health professionals, really don't want to go there. They don't want to push this to that kind of binary. They would just say, we're being incredibly sensitive. You know, we're taking, this is often called patient-centered care. So I take my cue from the patient. If the patient says, you know, this is a baby, I'm caring for my baby, then yes, we use all the baby language. We're being very patient sensitive and caring. But if it becomes apparent that the language that is being used, what is being implied, is that this being is not wanted, or that it's a pregnancy or whatever, then we'll be patient centered. We'll seamlessly move to this other language. And, and many practitioners say, you know, I'm not a philosopher, I'm not a theologian, I'm not going to make any decisions about the moral status of the unborn, I'm simply being sensitive.
And I can see how that is a very helpful way to frame it when you're thinking of yourself as a service provider. These are my clients, even customers, and therefore I need to let them frame what's going on here, and as you say, above all, be sensitive to their language and their terms. But it feels to me fundamentally dissatisfying, because it does seem to say that we don't know or believe or care if that thing, person, whatever you want to think of it, inside the womb is like, I mean in there is an objective reality. There must surely be. Humans cannot be entirely contingent on other human beings. There must be an objective reality. And it's, there's a kind of, it feels to me like there's a willful, as you say, refusal to stare that tension in the face and admit to the incoherence, because it's just kind of difficult to acknowledge that we're actually acting in two mutually contradictory ways.
I agree with you. We've been told before in these podcasts we should try and have more disagreement, but I'm sorry, Tim, I'm going to have to agree with you here. I mean, the fascinating thing is that once the baby is born, whether the parents want this baby or don't want this baby makes no difference at all to our commitment to the baby. I mean, now society is saying this baby has a unique value, and the fact that some people want this baby, some people don't want this baby, some people are positive, some people are less positive, some people are wanting giving this baby up for adoption, whatever, doesn't make any difference to the value and the significance of the baby. So there is this extraordinary incoherence. Once the baby's born, everybody says it's the unique status of the baby. But it's the unborn, it's the hidden being that we can now have this almost postmodern kind of view. Well, it all depends. It's a language game. And,
the Schrodinger's cat, isn't it? it changes depending on how you look at it.
Yeah. There is something about that. And so that's why I think more discussion about the narratives, more discussion about the reality. And I think this is where the Baby Loss Awareness Week is helpful, because it's just recognizing reality. It's bringing it out of ideology. It's bringing it out of culture wars and pro-life versus pro-choice. And it's just saying, can we please recognize the reality of what's happening here?
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating to me that you might actually, have some unexpected allies in this desire to kind of be more honest around abortion from some of the more kind of radical end of the pro-abortion lobby. There's a movement in America I'm aware of called Shout Your Abortion, which is, again, an effort to kind of break the stigma, but it's led entirely by people who believe very passionately in a woman's right to an abortion all the way up to 40 weeks. And they see society's kind of squeamishness to talk about it and to confront what is happening, and insistence that this is a private act that is very sensitive and personal, we don't go there, is kind of the conspiracy of silence that actually hinders their cause of expanding access to abortion. So I think it's fascinating that this idea of telling stories and being more honest about what is going on, you might actually have met at the other end, or come all the way around and met some of people you unlikely allies.
Yes, and there is a kind of theological, spiritual aspect to all this, and that is that, if we ultimately believe that what matters is truth and transparency, and that facing reality, however painful, however difficult it is fundamentally better than cloaking things in silence, using euphemisms, not recognizing the reality of what is taking place in our own homes and our own society. There is a fundamental Christian desire for transparency, honesty, and speaking the truth, but at the same time, speaking the truth in love, being sensitive, recognizing the deep, deep emotions. And of course, the reality is, for so many women who are choosing to have an abortion, by pills, by post, they're doing it with a desperately heavy heart. They're doing it because they feel there is no alternative, whether it's because they feel with a cost of living crisis, a child at this moment would be just destructive on and my future destructive in my life, destructive in my relationships. But I think the reality when one speaks to women honestly is that so many do feel this deep conflict the people who work in crisis pregnancy centers sometimes talk about the head heart, the conflict between my head is telling me that this is an entirely rational decision, that now is the wrong time for me to become a mother and so on, that economically it would be disastrous and it would affect my education and so on. There's all these rational reasons, and yet my heart is telling me something different, that this is my child and that I should care and protect and love my child. And so I think just being honest about the conflict that women find themselves in. And isn't it tragic that it's often because of social pressures or pressures from an unsupportive male partner which is driving women to have abortions, rather than this genuine autonomy? It's my body, it's my choice, I do whatever I like. That, I'm afraid, is by and large a myth.
And there's one very tragic case we didn't mention earlier that kind of elucidates this point you're making, where a woman was convicted of taking pills by post when she was long, long past the legal limit here in the UK. She was between 32 and 34 weeks pregnant, and pills by post are only supposed to be used for pregnancies up to 10 weeks. But she had basically misled when she did her kind of online consultation, was not honest about how far along she was. And she was, you know, ultimately caught and prosecuted and convicted. The child was born not breathing and confirmed dead shortly afterwards. And so she was kind of convicted of inducing an abortion after the legal limit, and initially given a prison sentence of, I believe, 2.5 years, which was prompted enormous kind of outrage and outcry here in the UK. But it raises some really difficult questions, particularly as when you find out more about her background, which is that she already had 3 children. I believe one of them had special needs. She was racked with guilt and suffered depression, and kind of fell pregnant during lockdown when she was quite isolated. And yeah, just a really difficult background. And so you can understand how she got to the place of kind of lying to get access to an abortion. But at the same time, you know, if there is to be a legal limit, then the law has to enforce it, does it not?
Yes. And as you say, there was a great deal of outrage. And there is a movement here in the UK from pro-abortion activists to completely decriminalise abortion, to make it, to have it regarded simply as a medical procedure like any other medical procedure, but not to be controlled or governed by specific law. When this case hit the headlines, a number of abortion activists saw this as an opportunity to push their case for decriminalisation. But I think, you know, I have previously argued that the law has a role because it basically reflects what society as a whole believes. And so the question we've got to ask ourselves is, do as a society, do we really believe that the life of a baby who's capable of living and being born alive, that life is to be protected? And basically that's what our law currently says. And the fact that somebody is held to account and found guilty of a law doesn't mean that they are criminalized. It doesn't mean that they have to be treated as a criminal or imprisoned. And so I think actually the subsequent judgment that she was found guilty of procuring abortion illegally, but was not imprisoned and allowed to carry on caring for her existing children, was a just sentence. In other words, there's a distinction between being found guilty of offending against the law and then deciding what a just sentence should be.
Absolutely. I think, so to end the story, a few months later, the case went to the appeal court, and the appeal court reduced her sentence from 28 months to 14 months and also suspended it, which basically meant that, you know, she wouldn't actually serve 14 months in prison unless she kind of reoffended again in the future, She's obviously highly unlikely, and so she effectively, you know, walked free, but is still a convicted, you know, criminal. And, you know, to use that language, she's broken the law, and she is, released from prison on license, as it were.
There's an analogy here which I've frequently been involved with discussions about, and that is when a partner, for instance, assists the suicide or of a partner who is begging to be helped to die. For instance, they've got severe terminal illness. Technically, if that partner assists the person in dying, out of compassion, they are still guilty of the law of assisted suicide, against the law of prohibiting assisted suicide. But the Crown Prosecution Service in general will say, you know, if it was clear that this was genuinely motivated by compassion, that you didn't get any financial gain of it yourself, and so on and so on, therefore you are not imprisoned. You are you're held guilty of the crime, but you are not treated as worthy of imprisonment. So, and I think that balance between holding the law, but then showing compassion in the way that punishment is enacted is an important balance.
And there's a reason, isn't there, why in our and in most legal systems there are two separate hearings or two separate legal processes. You have a kind of a fact-finding one where you try and decide, did this person do what they are accused of? And then if they are found guilty, you then have a secondary one, which is, what is the appropriate just punishment for this? And that might be going to prison, but actually in many cases, and not just for these, but lots of other laws, a judge rightly decides, you know, sending this person to prison is actually not going to be in their or in society's wider interest, even though they have broken the law. Let's actually sentence them to a fine, community service, or sometimes just, you know, just it lays on file that, you know, there isn't any actual punishment per se, but except the fact that they have been found guilty in a court of law. And that seems to me important to keep those two issues separate, whereas I think a lot of the pro-abortion, or at least the pro-decriminalization advocates, use this very difficult case to say the whole law around abortion is clearly unjust, because how can you justify this mother of three going to prison? And therefore, we should sweep away the whole thing, which, as you say, is a slightly deceptive way of saying, actually, I believe that women should be able to end pregnancies at any time of their choosing for any reason, which is a relatively radical position that doesn't have particularly wide support among the British public.
But the other really important thing to say here, and that is that if the previous abortion regulations were being carried out, in other words, if this was not pills by post, what would have happened is that she would have had to have had an ultrasound scan in the abortion clinic. They would have seen immediately that she was much more than 10 weeks. They would have worked out this baby was 30 weeks gestation, and they would have said, absolutely no way, you cannot have an abortion. So it was predicted at the time of pills by post that precisely this thing is going to happen, mothers are going to either deliberately or unintentionally get the gestational age wrong. If you don't do an ultrasound scan, it's bound to happen. And yet those who are promoting it said, no, it's not, nothing to worry about here. You know, we can trust women and so on. So I'm afraid that this kind of incident, where in fact the pregnancy was much more advanced than was anticipated, will continue to occur repeatedly, and there are already other cases of it happening. And this is the problem: if you never do an ultrasound scan, if you simply take the mother's word that she's less than 10 weeks.
And what do you think we do about this information? You know, for those of us who, as Christians, would like to see a reduction in the number of abortions that take place, do you think we should kind of leap upon some of these stories, or the changes in law around pills by post, and even the growing kind of awareness around miscarriage and baby loss, and kind of hammer that home and use that in our campaigning and say, look, a fetus can't be simultaneously a loved baby or a clump of cells at the same time, and kind of pull people's attention to what we fleshed out with some of the kind of incoherent thinking we have on it? Or is that actually quite exploitative, and is that you know, instrumentalizing and manipulating around a separate issue, which is, you know, the public policy question of pills by post and the question of how do we be more compassionate to those suffering from miscarriage. And it's actually a disservice to people who've experienced baby loss to almost drag them into the bitter, polarized debate around abortion.
Well, I think, you know, you'll put your finger on what is such a dilemma, to know what is a positive, healthy, compassionate response. I think I am convinced that just changing the law is not in itself a solution. You know, the evidence is emerging in the USA that despite the fact that a number of states have made abortion virtually illegal under all circumstances, that the total number of abortions that are taking place across the USA is probably not significantly changed, so that changing the law hasn't led to a very significant reduction in the total number of abortions. It's just meant that a lot of people are passing across state borders or finding other ways of getting access to abortion drugs. So I am a believer in the slogan that says our goal is not to make abortion illegal, it is to make it unthinkable. And so the question is, well, how do we change attitudes? How is it possible for attitudes to change? And I think that's where the baby loss awareness, it is possible that as you help people to tell their stories, as we try to break this silence and then ask the question, you know, is there a better way? Is there a better way of dealing with this problem of unplanned pregnancy? Is there a compassionate and thoughtful way? And the short answer is that I'm sure there is a better way, but we have to bring these issues out into the public. You know, the better way is the way of genuinely providing a positive support for women who are pregnant, helping them to see there is an option. You don't have to have an abortion. Reducing the stigma of being a single parent, providing better welfare and care and compassionate support, reducing the shame and so on. There are positive ways of responding to an unplanned pregnancy. But first we have to give people permission, an opportunity to share their stories.
And how would you respond to the accusation that if you start pulling in, you know, language and ideas from Baby Loss Awareness Week to this conversation, you are kind of being as manipulative as some of those pro decriminalization people were when they were jumping on this tragic case of the woman who procured an abortion illegally? You know, a person might say, you know, my miscarriage has nothing to do with your campaign to reduce abortion. Don't drag me into this.
Well, I would say my goal is not to have some massive public campaign talking about don't murder your babies or something like that, because I personally just don't think that helps. There are others who I respect who do believe that using that kind of language and you know, graphically confronting people with images and so on is helpful. I personally think what I would love to feel is to allow the women themselves to tell their stories, because I think that in itself would be very powerful and would cause people to question, you know, what is going on here? Is this a healthy way? Is this a positive social trend, or is there a better way? That's so I'm not trying to manipulate or coerce or abuse language, but I do would love to see greater honesty and transparency.
And you can see the power of story used very effectively in Baby Loss Awareness Week, you know, which makes a big deal out of sharing the story, some of which we shared earlier on the last week's podcast. And we live in a moment, it feels like to me, a cultural moment in where there is enormous weight placed on the power of story. You know, you see that through like events like Me Too, you know, where people said, actually, hang on, if we just stop and listen to women talking about their experiences of harassment and abuse and assault, that actually, in my view, kind of reshapes society in some significant ways. And so I can certainly see the power of saying, let's encourage and make it possible for women to talk about their abortion stories. And that has a cultural capital right now in Britain, even in secular Britain, that is kind of hard to deny. Right. Well, we've covered a lot of ground there, but I hope it was an interesting conversation to listen into. As I mentioned last week, we don't want to pretend that we have all the answers on this, particularly as two blokes. So please do send us your thoughts, your reflections, your disagreements. We're really interested to hear what you, the listeners, made of this conversation and make of these big kind of cultural shifts that we're seeing around questions of baby loss and pregnancy and abortion. So please do get in touch with us. You can email MOLAD, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. And if you're interested in digging into the question of abortion and Christian ethics a bit more, Dad's got a great section on his website, johnwyatt.com, that kind of takes you through with a kind of primer and then into some kind of gradually unfolding into some more in-depth written pieces and stuff like that. So do take a look at that. That's johnwyatt.com. And otherwise, we'll be back next week with another episode of Matters of Life and Ten. We'll be back next week with another episode of Matters of Life and Death. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.